children, admittedly, but he adopted the people. None of these young men spoke the word emperor. Jean Prouvaire alone sometimes said Napoleon, or the others said Bonaparte. Enjolras pronounced it Buonaparte. Marius was vaguely amazed. Initium sapientiae. The back room of the Café Musain. One of the conversations these young men had, conversations that Marius sat in on and sometimes took part in, was a real eye-opener for Marius, and shook him up quite badly. It happened in the back room of the Café Musain. Just about all the friends of the ABC were there that night. The oil lamp had been solemnly lit. They talked about this and that, noisily, passionlessly. Except for Enjolras and Marius, who kept silent, everyone joined in the aimless ranting. Talk among friends sometimes reaches this quietly tumultuous pitch. It was more random banter than conversation. Words were tossed around and caught. The talk was coming from all sides. No woman was admitted into this back room except Louison, the café dishwasher, who passed through from time to time on her way from the laundry to the laboratory. Grantaire, perfectly plastered, was deafening everyone in the corner he'd taken possession of. He reasoned and raved at the top of his lungs, shouting, "I'm thirsty! Mortals, I have a dream! That the Heidelberg tun has an attack of apoplexy, and that I am among the dozen leeches they apply to it. I want to drink. I want to forget life. Life is a hideous invention of who knows who. It doesn't last two ups, and it's not worth two ups. You break your neck trying to stay alive. Life is a stage set where nothing much actually works. Happiness is an old theater flat painted on one side only. Ecclesiastes says all is vanity. I couldn't agree more with the poor bastard, if he ever existed. Zero, not wishing to get around in the nude, decked itself out in vanity. Oh, vanity, the tarting up of everything in grand words. A kitchen is a laboratory, a dancer is a professor, an acrobat is a gymnast, a boxer is a pugilist, an apothecary is a chemist, a wig maker is an artiste, a plasterer's helper is an architect, a jockey is a sportsman, a woodlouse is a pterygobranchiate. Vanity has a back and a front. The front is stupid. It's the nigger decked out in his glass baubles. The back is silly. It's the philosopher in rags. One makes me cry and the other makes me laugh. What are called honors and dignities, and even real honor and dignity, are generally fake gold. Kings make a mockery of human pride. Caligula made a horse a consul. Charles II made a sirloin steak a knight. So now you can drape yourselves between the consul incitatus and the baronet roast beef. As for people's intrinsic worth, that's hardly any more respectable. Listen to the sort of praise a person heaps on their neighbor. White attacking white is ferocious. If the lily could talk, it'd make mincemeat of the dove. A bigot who tells tales about someone devout is more poisonous than an asp or a blue viper. It's a pity I'm an ignoramus, or I would cite a whole host of examples for you, but I know nothing. For instance, I've always been a bit of a wit. When I was studying under Gros, the painter, instead of mucking about, daubing piddling little paintings, I spent my time pilfering apples. Rapin, dauber, is the masculine of rapine, plunder. So much for me. As for the rest of you, you're as bad as I am. I don't give a fig for your perfections, excellences, and good qualities. Every good quality ends in a defect. The man who looks after his money verges on the miser. The generous man borders on the wastrel. The brave man is pretty close to the braggart. When you say very pious, you say holier than thou. There are just as many vices in virtue as there are holes in Diogenes' mantle. Who do you admire, the one killed or the killer? Caesar or Brutus? Generally, people are for the killer. Long live Brutus. He killed. That's virtue for you. Virtue? Very well, but madness too. Those great men there have some very strange blemishes. The Brutus who killed Caesar was in love with the statue of a little boy. This statue was made by the Greek sculptor Strongylion, who also sculpted the figure of an Amazon called Beautiful Legs, Eucnemus, which Nero took with him on his jaunts. This Strongylion has left only two statues that Brutus and Nero agreed about. Brutus was in love with one of them, and Nero was in love with the other. The whole of history is just one long rehash. One century plagiarizes another. The Battle of Marengo copies the Battle of Pydna. Clovis's Tolbiac and Napoleon's Austerlitz are as alike as two drops of blood. I don't hold much store by victory. What could be stupider than winning? The real glory is in winning over. But just you try and prove anything. You're satisfied with succeeding. What mediocrity! And with conquering! How pathetic! Alas, nothing but vanity and cowardice everywhere you turn. Everything bows down before success, even grammar. Si volet usus, says Horace. And so I despise the human race. Shall we descend from the whole to the part? Would you like me to admire the peoples of the world? Which particular people, if you please? Do you mean Greece? The Athenians, those Parisians of bygone days, killed Phocion, or Coligny, as we might say, and crawled to the tyrants to the point where Anacephorus said of Pisistratus, his urine attracts bees. The most important man in Greece for 50 years was the grammarian, Philetus, who was so tiny and thin that he was forced to put lead in his shoes so he didn't blow away in the breeze. In the biggest square in Corinth, there was a statue sculpted by Silanion and catalogued by Pliny. This statue represented Epistates. What did Epistates do? He invented the wrestling move known as tripping someone up. That about sums up the glory of Greece. Let's move on to other peoples. Shall I admire England? Shall I admire France? France? What for? Because of Paris? I've just told you what I think of Athens. England? What for? Because of London? I hate Carthage. Then again, London, metropolis of luxury, is the capital of destitution. Every year in the parish of Charing Cross alone, 100 people die of starvation. So much for Albion. I add, to cap it off, that I once saw an Englishwoman dancing with a crown of roses and blue spectacles. So, a big hiss and a boo for England. If I don't admire John Bull, am I then to admire Brother Jonathan? I'm not too keen on this slave-owning brother. Take away time is money and what's left of England. Take away cotton is king and what's left of America. Germany is lymphatic. Italy is full of bile. Should we go into raptures over Russia? Voltaire admired it. He also admired China. I grant that Russia has its good points, among others a strong despotism, but I feel sorry for despots. Their health is delicate. An Alexis decapitated, a Peter stabbed, a Paul strangled, another Paul stomped on and kicked to death by jackboots. Sundry Ivans have had their throats cut. Several Nicholases and Basils have been poisoned. All this indicates that the palace of the emperors of Russia was a flagrantly insalubrious place. All civilized peoples offer the thinker this little detail for his admiration. War. Now, war, civilized war, sums up and exhausts all forms of banditry, from the armed robbery of the Catalan bands in the gorges of Mount Jaxa to the marauding of the Comanche Indians in Doubtful Pass. Bah, you'll say to me, Europe is still better than Asia, surely? I agree that Asia is a joke, but I don't really see what you can afford to laugh about. In the great Lama, you peoples of the West, who have blended with your fashions and your elegant ways all the ornate filth of majesty, from the dirty chemise of Queen Isabella to the Dauphin's commode. Messieurs of the human race, I say, screw the lot of you. In Brussels, they drink the most beer, in Stockholm, the most eau-de-vie, in Madrid, the most chocolate, in Amsterdam, the most gin, in London, the most wine, in Constantinople, the most coffee, in Paris, the most absinthe. That's it for all the most useful notions. In a word, Paris wins, hands down. In Paris, even the rag-and-bone merchants are sybarites. Diogenes would have been just as happy as a rag-and-bone man in the Place Maubert as he was as a philosopher in Piraeus. And there's something else you should know. The rag-and-bone men's cabarets are called bibines, watering holes where they serve cheap booze. The most famous are the casserole and the abattoir. And so, oh, open-air cafes, gin shops, little lion eateries, seedy dives, greasy spoons, pothouses, sleazy dance halls, smoky flea-pit groggeries with your zinc counters, dishwater bars of the rag-and-bone merchants, caravanserai of the caliphs. I swear to you, I am a voluptuary. I eat at Richard's at 40 sous a head, and I need a Persian carpet to roll Cleopatra up in, naked. Where is Cleopatra? Ah, it's you, Louison. Hello! And so the words streamed out of Grantaire in his corner of the back room of the Café Musain as he buttonholed the dishwasher on her way past, Grantaire being more than drunk by then. Bossuet put out his hand and tried to shut him up, but Grantaire started up again, even louder.
Aigle de Meaux, mitts off! You don't impress me, imitating the gesture of Hippocrates when he rejected Artaxerxes' hodgepodge. I exempt you from calming me down. Besides, I'm sad. What do you want me to say? Man is bad, man is deformed. The butterfly is a success. Man is a botched job. God bungled that particular animal. A crowd offers you a choice of ugliness. The first man that comes along is a miserable bastard. Femme rhymes with infamy. Of course I'm suffering from spleen, complicated with melancholy, nostalgia plus hypochondria, and I rant and rage and yawn and bore myself. I bore myself to tears. I bore myself to death. God can go to hell.
Well then, shut up, capital R, said Bossuet, who was discussing a point of law with the company at large and was up to his neck in legal jargon, his closing remarks going like this. As for me, although I'm barely a jurist, at best an amateur attorney, I maintain this, that according to the custom of Normandy, every year at Michaelmas, a token sum must be paid for the benefit of the seigneur, unless others are entitled by each and every title holder, whether by lease or right of succession, and this for all long leases, allodiums, private estate and state contracts, mortgages and mortgagees.
Echo, plaintive nymph, hummed Grantaire.
Right next to Grantaire, at an almost silent table, a sheet of paper, an inkwell, and a plume between two small glasses announced that a vaudeville sketch was being drafted. This very serious matter was being tackled by two people talking in low voices with their heads together. Let's start by finding the names. When we have the names, we have the subject. Right you are. You dictate, I'll write. Monsieur Dorimont? Man of means? Of course. His daughter Celestine? Teen. Next? Colonel Saint-Val. Saint-Val's a bit tired. I'd say Balsain. Alongside these vaudeville aspirants, another group, which was also taking advantage of the racket to whisper together privately, was discussing a duel. An old-timer, 30 years old, was advising a young whippersnapper, 18 years old, about the adversary he was dealing with.
Christ, be careful. He's a beautiful sword. He plays clean. He's got attack. No wasted feints. Good wrist action. Real sparkle. Lightning fast. Good parry. Accurate cut and thrust. Heavens, and he's left-handed.
In the corner opposite Grantaire, Joly and Bahorel were playing dominoes and talking about love. "You're a happy man, you are," Joly was saying. "You've got a mistress who never stops laughing."
"That's a mistake on her part," replied Bahorel.
"A man's mistress is wrong to laugh. It only encourages you to be unfaithful to her. Seeing her so gay takes away any remorse. If you see her sad, it pricks your conscience."
"Ungrateful bastard! A woman who laughs is a treasure. And you never, ever fight. That's because we've made a pact when we formed our little holy alliance. We drew lines we never cross. Anything on the wintry side belongs to Vaux, on the windy side, to Jex. Hence the peace."
"Peace is happiness, digesting. But what about you, Julie? Where are you up to in your falling out with what's-her-name? You know the one I mean."
"She's still sulking. It's shocking how long she can sulk.
Yet you're so lovesick you're wasting away."
"Alas.
If I were you, I'd dump her. Easy to say. Easy to do, too. Doesn't she call herself Musichetta?"
"Yes. Ah, my poor Bahorel. She's a wonderful girl, very literary. Tiny feet, tiny hands, dresses well, white, plump, eyes of a fortune-teller. I'm mad about her."
"My dear man, in that case you have to sweep her off her feet. Be elegant. Bowl her over. Get yourself a pair of doeskin pants run up at Staub's. They stretch."
"How much are they?" cried Grantaire.
The third corner was in the throes of a poetry discussion. Pagan mythology was going head-to-head with Christian mythology. The subject was Olympus, whose side Jean Prouvaire took out of sheer romanticism. Jean Prouvaire was only timid at rest. Once he got excited, he erupted, a sort of gaiety accentuated his enthusiasm, and he was both laughing and lyrical. "Let's not insult the gods," he was saying. "The gods have not, perhaps, left us. Jupiter doesn't strike me as being dead yet.
The gods are mere dreams, you say, yet now, when all these dreams have flown, the grand old pagan myths are still with us, even in nature, such as it is today. A mountain like Vignemale, for instance, which looks like a fortress from the side, is still, for me, Cybele's headdress. It has not, to my mind, been proven that Pan doesn't come out at night to blow in the hollow trunk of a willow, stopping the holes with his fingers one by one. And I've always thought that Io had a hand in the waterfall of Pisavash. In the last corner, they were talking politics. They were pulling apart the charter that had just been granted. Combeferre was limply defending it. Courfeyrac was energetically demolishing it. There was an unfortunate copy of the famous Touquet Charter on the table in front of them, and Courfeyrac grabbed it and was waving it around, supporting his arguments with the rustling of that sheet of paper.
"First, I want no kings. I'll have none of that, if only for economic reasons. A king is a parasite. Kings don't come free. Listen to this. The high cost of kings.
At the death of François Ier, the public debt in France was 30,000 livres in revenue. At the death of Louis XIV, it was 2,600,000,000 at 28 livres a mark, which, according to Desmarais, was equivalent to 4,500,000,000 in 1760, which is equivalent to 12 billion today. Second, whether Combeferre likes it or not, granting charters is not something civilization should resort to.
To ease the transition, smooth the passage, dampen the shock, make the nation's shift from monarchy to democracy imperceptible through the spinning of constitutional fictions, these are all despicable justifications. No, no! We must never light the people's way with false daylight. Principles wither and fade in your constitutional cave. No bastardization, no compromise, no grant from the king to the people. In all such grants there is an Article 14. Alongside the hand that feeds, there is the claw that takes it all back. I reject your charter outright. A charter is a mask. Underneath it is the lie. A nation that accepts a charter abdicates. Rights are only rights when they are whole. No, no charter.
It was winter time. Two logs were crackling in the fireplace. It was tempting, and Courfeyrac could not resist. He crumpled the poor Touquet charter in his hand and tossed it on the fire. The paper caught fire. Combeferre watched philosophically as Louis XVIII's masterpiece burned, and all he said was, "The charter has gone up in flames." And the sarcastic jibes, the sallies, the taunts, the thing the French call wit and the English call humor, good taste and bad, good reasoning and bad, all the wild projectiles of repartee flared up all at once and cross-fired from all points of the room, creating a sort of joyous bombardment overhead.
The horizon expands. The wonderful thing about the clash of young minds is that you can never predict the spark or foresee the lightning flash of the explosion it sets off. Anything could erupt at any moment, you have no idea what. A burst of laughter starts out as tender emotion. During a bout of buffoonery, seriousness makes its entrance. Stimulus is provided by the slightest chance word. The verve of each is at its peak. A quip is enough to open the field up to the unexpected. This is the kind of talk that takes sharp turns where the perspective suddenly changes completely. Chance is the scene shifter in such conversations. A harsh thought, oddly emerging from the clatter of words, suddenly pierced through the verbal free-for-all in which Grantaire, Bahorel, Prouvaire, Bossuet, Combeferre, and Courfeyrac were chaotically clashing swords. How does a single phrase stand out in the middle of a conversation? How does it manage to suddenly stop everyone in their tracks? As we just said, nobody knows. In the middle of the din, Bossuet ended whatever he had been saying to Combeferre with this date. June 18th, 1815, Waterloo. At the mention of Waterloo, Marius, who was leaning on the table beside a glass of water, took his hand away from under his chin and began to study the room in earnest.
"God Almighty!" cried Courfeyrac.
Good Lord was by then falling into disuse.
"The number 18 strikes me as odd. It's Bonaparte's fatal number. Put Louis in front and Brumaire behind, and you have the man's entire destiny, with this amazing peculiarity, which is that the end follows hot on the heels of the beginning."
Enjolras,
who had not said a word till then, broke his silence and addressed Courfeyrac. "You mean atonement follows hot on the heels of the crime?" That word, crime, exceeded the limits of what Marius could endure, deeply stirred as he already was by the sudden evocation of Waterloo. He got up, walked slowly over to the map of France spread out on the wall, at the bottom of which you could see an island in a separate box, and he stuck his finger on this box and said, "Corsica, a tiny island that has made France truly great." This was like a blast of Arctic air. Everyone broke off. You could have heard a pin drop. Something was clearly about to take off. Bahorel, about to retort to Bossuet, had been taking up a favorite pose. He dropped it to listen. Enjolras, whose blue eyes were not fixed on anyone, seemingly staring into space, answered without looking at Marius, "France doesn't need any Corsica to be great. France is great because it is France. Quia nominor Leo." Marius did not feel even the vaguest desire to retreat. He turned toward Enjolras, and he spoke in a voice ringing with emotion. "God forbid that I should diminish France. But it is not diminishing it by assimilating Napoleon to it. All right, so let's talk. I'm new here, but I have to confess, you amaze me. Where are we at? Who are we? Who are you? Who am I? Let's be clear about the Emperor. I hear you say Buonaparte, emphasizing the U the way the royalists do. I warn you that my grandfather goes one better still. He says Buonaparte. I thought you were young men. So where are you putting your enthusiasm, then? And what are you doing with it? Who do you admire if you don't admire the Emperor? And what more do you need? If you don't want anything to do with that great man, what great men do you want? He had everything. He was complete. He had every human faculty in his brain, to the nth degree. He drew up codes like Justinian. He ruled alone like Caesar. When he talked, he mixed Pascal's lightning wit with the thunder of Tacitus. He made history, and he wrote it. His bulletins are Iliads. He combined Newton's mathematics with Muhammad's metaphors. He left behind him in the Orient words as great as the pyramids. At Tilsit, he taught majesty to emperors. At the Académie des Sciences, he had answers for Laplace. At the Council of State, he held his ground with Merlin. He gave soul to the geometry of some and to the chicanery of others. He talked law with attorneys and the stars with astronomers. Like Cromwell, blowing out alternate candles, he took himself off to the temple to haggle over a curtain tassel. He saw everything, he knew everything. But that didn't stop him from laughing with joy like an ordinary man at his little baby's cradle. And all of a sudden, Europe sat up and listened. Armies went on the march, artillery parks rolled along, pontoon bridge trains stretched out over the rivers. Clouds of cavalry galloped in the whirlwind, shouts, trumpets, everywhere the tottering of thrones, the borders of kingdoms wobbling on the map. You could hear the swoosh of a superhuman broadsword sliding out of its sheath. You could see him, the man himself, standing tall on the horizon with a blaze in his hand and a resplendent light in his eyes, deploying his two wings, the Grande Armée and the Old Guard, amid all the thunder, and there he was, the Archangel of War. No one spoke. Enjolras hung his head. Silence always acts a bit like assent or backing someone into a corner. Marius, almost without pausing for breath, went on with added exuberance. "Let's be fair, my friends. To be the empire of such an emperor, what more splendid destiny for a nation when that nation is France and when its genius is added to the genius of the man? To come out of nowhere and take the reins, to march and to triumph, to have all the capitals of Europe as stops along the way, to take his grenadiers and turn them into kings, to decree the downfall of dynasties, to change the face of Europe as you charge on, for people to feel when you threaten them that you have your hand on the hilt of the sword of God, to follow Hannibal, Caesar, and Charlemagne in the person of one man, to be the nation of a man who greets you every dawn with the glorious announcement of a battle won, to have the cannon of the Invalides as your alarm clock, to hurl into the endless light mighty words that blaze out for all time, Marengo, Arcola, Austerlitz, Jena, Wagram, at every instant to cause constellations of victories to come out in the zenith of the centuries, to offer the French Empire as a counterpart to the Roman Empire, to be the grand nation that gives birth to the Grande Armée, sending its legions flying over the face of the earth the way a mountain sprays its eagles in all directions, to vanquish, dominate, crush, to be Europe's golden nation,
ablaze with glory, to sound a titanic fanfare down through history, to conquer the world twice over by force of arms and by dazzlement. All this is sublime. What could possibly be greater?
To be free, said Combeferre. It was Marius's turn to hang his head. That simple, chilling word had cut through his epic effusion like a steel blade, and he felt it fall away inside him. When he raised his eyes, Combeferre was no longer there, satisfied, no doubt, with pulling the rug from under Marius just as he reached his grand finale. He had simply left, and everyone except Enjolras had followed suit. The room had emptied. Enjolras, left alone with Marius, looked at him gravely. Marius, though, having made an effort to rally his ideas, did not consider himself defeated. There was still something bubbling away inside him that would no doubt translate into syllogisms deployed against Enjolras. Then, all of a sudden, someone could be heard singing on the stairs as they went away. It was Combeferre, and this is what he sang. If Caesar had offered me glory and war, but I had had to give up my mother's love, I would say to great Caesar, take back your scepter and your chariot. I love my mother more, hey, Nonny. I love my mother more. The tender and savage tone in which Combeferre was singing gave this verse a sort of strange grandeur. Marius, pensive and with his eyes on the ceiling, repeated almost mechanically, my mother. At that moment, he felt Enjolras' hand on his shoulder. Citizen, said Enjolras, my mother is the Republic. Res Angusta. That soiree left Marius deeply shaken, with a sad darkness in his soul. He felt what the earth perhaps feels, as it is being dug into by iron for seeds of wheat to be sown. It feels only the wound, the bursting of the wheat germ into life, and the thrill of the wheat only come later. Marius was forlorn. He had only just acquired a faith. Did he have to reject it already? He told himself no. He resolved not to doubt. But he started to have doubts just the same. To be between two religions, one you have not yet emerged from, the other you have not yet embraced, is unbearable. And such gloomy half-light only appeals to bat-like souls. Marius was open-eyed, and he needed real light. The crepuscular light of doubt hurt him. Whatever his desire to stay put and to hold out, he was invincibly compelled to move on, to advance, to examine, to think, to go one step further. Where was all that going to lead him? He feared, after having taken so many steps that had drawn him closer to his father, to take steps now that would take him away from him. His uneasiness grew with every thought that came to him. High walls hemmed him in on all sides. He did not fit in with either his grandfather or his friends. He was reckless according to the one, backward according to the others. And he recognized that he was doubly cut off, from the old and from the young. He stopped going to the Café Musain. In this troubled state of mind, he barely gave a thought to certain serious aspects of existence. But the realities of life do not let themselves be forgotten. They suddenly came and gave him a sharp nudge. One morning, the hotel keeper sailed into Marius's room and said, Monsieur Courfeyrac has vouched for you. Yes, but I need money. Ask Courfeyrac to come and speak to me, said Marius. Courfeyrac came. The host left them to it. Marius now told him what he had not thought of telling him before this, which was that he was all alone in the world, not having any relatives. What's going to become of you? Said Courfeyrac.
I have no idea, Marius replied.
What are you going to do?
I have no idea.
Have you got any money?
15 francs.
Would you like me to lend you some?
Not on your life.
Have you got any clothes?
What you see.
Any jewelry?
A watch?
Silver?
Gold. Here it is.
I know a second-hand clothes dealer who'll take a redingote and a pair of pants.
That's good.
You'll only have one pair of pants, a waistcoat, a hat, and a morning coat left.
And my boots.
What?
You mean you won't go barefoot? What luxury!
It'll do me.
I know a watchmaker who'll buy your watch. That's good. No, it's not good. What are you going to do after that?
Whatever I have to. That's honest, at least.
Do you know English?
No.
Do you know German?
No.
Too bad.
Why?
It's just that one of my friends is a bookseller, and he's doing a sort of encyclopedia. And you could have translated articles from German or English for it. It's badly paid, but you can live on it.
I learn English and German.
And in the meantime?
In the meantime, I'll eat my clothes and my watch.
They sent for the clothes dealer. He bought the cast-offs for 20 francs. They went to the watchmaker's. He bought the watch for 45 francs.
That's not bad, said Marius to Courfeyrac on returning to the hotel.
With the 15 francs I already have, that comes to 80 francs.
What about the hotel bill? Observed Courfeyrac.
Ah, yes, I forgot, said Marius.
Christ,
went Courfeyrac. You'll eat up 5 francs while you're learning English and 5 francs while you're learning German. You'll either have to swallow a language pretty fast or 100 sous piece pretty slowly.
Meanwhile, Aunt Gillenormand, who was pretty good underneath it all in a crisis, wound up unearthing Marius's hideout. One morning, as Marius was coming back from the law school, he found a letter from his aunt and those 60 pistoles, that is, 600 francs in gold, in a sealed box. Marius sent the 30 louis back to his aunt with a respectful letter declaring he had the means to support himself and that he could now provide for all his needs on his own. At that point he had 3 francs left. The aunt did not inform the grandfather about this rejection for fear of exasperating him further. Besides, hadn't he said, "Never speak to me of that bloodsucker again"? Marius left the Hotel de la Porte Saint-Jacques, not wanting to run up a debt there. Book 5. The Virtues of Adversity. Marius, destitute. Life became tough for Marius. Eating his clothes and his watch was nothing. He had to swallow something more galling, which was his pride, forced as he was to live off the smell of an oily rag, as they say. A horrible thing that includes days without bread, nights without sleep, evenings without a candle, a fireplace without a fire, weeks without work, a future without hope, a coat worn through at the elbows, a hat so battered it makes girls giggle, a door you find closed at night because you can't pay the rent, the insolence of the porter and the pothouse proprietor, the snickering of neighbors, humiliation, dignity trampled underfoot, any odd jobs snapped up, disgust, bitterness, dejection. Marius learned how one devours all that, and how these are often all there is to devour. At that stage of existence when a man needs pride because he needs love, he felt derided because he was badly dressed and ridiculed because he was poor. At an age when the sap rises in a young man's heart with overweening arrogance, he more than once looked down at his gaping boots and felt the unjust shame and heart-rending embarrassment of destitution. A trial both awesome and terrible, out of which the weak emerge vile and the strong emerge sublime. Crucible into which fate hurls a man whenever it wants to make a mongrel or a demigod. For many great deeds are performed in the small struggles of life. There are dogged and unseen acts of bravery which defend themselves every inch of the way behind the scenes against the deadly invasion of necessity and depravity. Noble and mysterious triumphs that no other eyes see, that no renown rewards, that no fanfare salutes. Life, adversity, loneliness, abandonment, poverty are battlefields that have their heroes, obscure heroes, sometimes greater than the illustrious ones. Steadfast and rare natures are forged this way. Misery, almost always a stepmother, is sometimes a mother. Deprivation begets strength of soul and mind. Distress nurtures pride. Adversity is just the milk the magnanimous need. There was a moment in Marius's life when he swept his own doorstep,
when he bought brie by the sou at the grocer's, when he waited for dusk to fall to duck into the baker's and buy a loaf of bread, which he would then spirit away to the garret as though he had stolen it. Sometimes, slipping into the local butcher's in the thick of jeering cooks who jostled him, you would see an awkward young man with books tucked under his arm, looking timid and furious, who, when he came in, would take off his hat, the sweat beading on his forehead, bow deeply to the astonished butcher's wife, bow again to the butcher's boy, ask for a mutton chop, pay 6 or 7 sous for it, wrap it in paper, stick it under his arm between a couple of books, and be off. This was Marius. On this one chop, which he cooked himself, he could live for 3 days. The first day he would eat the meat, the second day he would eat the fat, the third day he would gnaw the bone. Several times, Angiennoman made overtures, sending him the 60 pistoles again. Marius always sent them back, saying he didn't need anything. He was still in mourning for his father when the revolution that we have described occurred in him. From that day forth, he never abandoned black clothes. His clothes, however, abandoned him. The day came when he had no coat left. The pants were still all right. What was he to do? Courfeyrac, for whom he, on his side, had done a few good turns, gave him an old coat of his. For 30 sous, Marius had it turned by some porter or other, and it was as good as new. But the coat was green, so Marius only went out after dark. That turned the coat black. Wanting to remain in mourning at all times, he clothed himself in night. Through all this, he got himself admitted to the bar. He was supposed to occupy Courfeyrac's chambers, which were decent and where a certain number of law books, bolstered and filled out by odd volumes of novels, made up the library required by the regulations. He saw to it that any correspondence was addressed to him, care of Courfeyrac. When Marius became a lawyer, he informed his grandfather of the fact in a letter that was cold but full of humility and respect. Monsieur Gillenormand took the letter in trembling hands, read it, ripped it in half, and chucked it into the waste-paper basket. 2 or 3 days later, Mademoiselle Gillenormand heard her father alone in his room talking out loud. This happened to him whenever he was really agitated. She cocked her ear, the old man was saying, "If you weren't such a noodle, you'd know you can't be a baron and a lawyer at the same time." Marius poor. Misery is like anything else. It reaches the point where it is bearable. It ends up taking shape and assuming a form. You vegetate, meaning you evolve in a certain stunted fashion, but that is enough to live on. This is how the existence of Marius Pontmercy had arranged itself. He had gotten through the worst of it. The defile was opening out a little before him. By dint of toil, courage, perseverance, and will, he had managed to get about 700 francs a year out of his work. He had learned German and English, thanks to Courfeyrac, who had put him in touch with his friend, the bookseller. Marius played, in the literary section of the bookshop, the modest role of hack. He drew up prospectuses, translated journals, annotated editions, compiled biographies, etc. Net result, year in, year out, 700 francs. He could live off that. Not too badly. How? We'll tell you. Marius occupied, in the Gorbeau slum, at the annual rate of 30 francs, a rat hole with no fireplace known as his chambers, where there was nothing by way of furniture but what was strictly indispensable. This furniture was his. He gave the old chief tenant 3 francs a month to come and sweep out the rat hole and bring him every morning a small supply of hot water, a fresh egg, and a little bread roll worth 1 sou. This bread roll and this egg were his breakfast. The cost of his breakfast varied from 2 to 4 sous, depending on whether eggs were cheap or dear. At 6 o'clock in the evening, he went down the Rue Saint-Jacques to dine at Rousseau's, opposite Basset's, the print dealer at the corner of the Rue des Martyrs. He didn't eat any soup. He would have the meat dish for 6 sous, a half serving of vegetables for 3 sous, and a dessert for 3 sous. For 3 sous, as much bread as he could eat. As for wine, he drank water. When he paid at the counter, where Madame Rousseau held sway, fat as ever but still fresh in those days, he gave a sou to the waiter, and Madame Rousseau gave him a smile. Then he took himself off. For 16 sous, he had a smile
and a meal. This restaurant, Rousseau, where so few bottles and so many carafes were emptied, was a balm more than a restaurant. It no longer exists today. The proprietor had a great nickname. They called him Rousseau the Aquatic. So, at 4 sous for breakfast and 16 sous for dinner, his food cost him 20 sous a day, which came to 365 francs a year. Add the 30 francs rent and the 36 francs for the old girl, plus a few minor expenses, and for 450 francs, Marius was fed, housed, and waited on. His clothing cost him 100 francs, his linen 50 francs, his laundry 50 francs. The whole did not exceed 650 francs. This left him 50 francs. He was rich. He occasionally lent a friend 10 francs. Courfeyrac was once able to borrow 60 francs from him. As for heating, not having a fireplace, Marius had simplified things. Marius always had 2 complete suits. One of them was old, for every day. The other was brand new, for special occasions. Both were black. He only had 3 shirts, one on his back, one in his chest of drawers, and the third at the laundry. He replaced them as they wore out. They were usually frayed, which meant he buttoned his coat right up to his chin. For Marius to reach this state of prosperity had taken years. Tough years, some hard to get through, others hard to get out of. Marius had never faltered for a single day. He had endured every kind of deprivation. He had done everything except get into debt. He paid himself this tribute that never had he owed anyone a sou. For him, owing money was the beginning of slavery. He even told himself that a creditor was worse than a boss. For a boss only owns your person, but a creditor owns your dignity and can slap it around. Rather than borrow, he went without eating. There had been many days of fasting, feeling that all extremes meet and that if you are not careful, abasement of fortune may lead to baseness of soul. He jealously watched over his pride. A phrase or an approach that in any other situation would have looked like respect to him struck him as obsequious, and he would brace himself against it. He took no risks, not wanting to take a backward step. His face was covered in angry red blotches. He was so shy, he was rude. In all these trials and tribulations, he felt heartened and sometimes even buoyed by a secret force within. The soul assists the body and at certain moments uplifts it. It is the only bird that can lift up its cage. Alongside his father's name, another name was engraved in Marius's heart, the name Thénardier. With his passionate and grave nature, Marius surrounded the man to whom he owed his father's life, or so he thought, that fearless sergeant who had saved the colonel as the cannonballs and bullets of Waterloo were raining down in a sort of glory. He never separated the memory of this man from the memory of his father, and in his veneration he connected them together. It was a sort of worship on 2 levels, with the big altar for the colonel and the little one for Thénardier. What intensified the tenderness of his gratitude was the notion of the misfortune that had befallen Thénardier and engulfed him. Marius had learned in Montfermeil of the ruin and bankruptcy of the hapless innkeeper. Since then, he had made unbelievable efforts to pick up the scent and track him down in the black pit of misery where Thénardier had disappeared. Marius had combed the countryside. He had gone to Chelles, Bondy, Gournay, Nogent, Lagny. For 3 years he had been hard at it, spending what little money he had saved in these explorations. Nobody had been able to give him any news of Thénardier. He was thought to have gone abroad. His creditors had looked for him, too, with less love than Marius, but with just as much keenness, and had not been able to get their hands on him. Marius blamed himself and almost hated himself for not getting anywhere in his searches. It was the sole debt that the colonel had left to him, and Marius considered it a point of honor that he should pay it. Heavens, he thought, when my father lay dying on the battlefield, Thénardier managed to find him through all the smoke and the grapeshot, and they carried him on his shoulders, and yet he owed him nothing, and I who owe so much to Thénardier, can't manage to reach him in this darkness where he lies in agony, and bring him back in my turn from death to life. Oh, I'll find him all right. To find Thénardier, indeed, Marius would have given his right arm, and to rescue him from misery, all his blood. To see Thénardier, to do something, anything,
for the man, to say to him, "You don't know me, but I know you. I'm here. Do what you will with me." This was the sweetest and the most glorious of Marius's dreams. Marius, grown up. Marius was now 20 years old. It was 3 years since he had left his grandfather. They had remained on the same terms on both sides, without any attempt at reconciliation or at seeing each other again. Besides, what was the point of seeing each other again? To get into a tussle? Which one would have come off best? Marius was a bronze vase, but old man Gillenormand was an iron pot. We must say Marius was wrong about his grandfather's heart. He imagined that Monsieur Gillenormand had never loved him, and that this abrupt, hard, derisive old man, who swore, yelled, stormed, and raised his cane, had most felt for him that affection, at once slight and severe, that the gérant of comedy felt. Marius was mistaken. There are fathers who do not love their sons. There is no grandfather in the world who does not love his grandson. At the end of the day, as we have said, Monsieur Gillenormand idolized Marius. He idolized him in his own way, to the accompaniment of shoves and even the odd slap. But with the boy gone, he felt a black emptiness in his heart. He insisted that no one mention him in front of him again, regretting to himself quietly that he should be so perfectly obeyed. At first he hoped that this Buonapartist, this Jacobin, this terrorist, this Septembrist, would come crawling back. But the weeks went by, the months went by, the years went by. To Monsieur Gillenormand's great despair, the bloodsucker never reappeared. "Yet I could hardly have done anything other than kick him out," the grandfather told himself, and he asked himself, "If it were to happen again, would I do it all over again?" His pride promptly answered yes, but his old head, which he shook in silence, sadly answered no. He had his hours of dejection. He missed Marius. Old men need affection like the sun. It means heat. However strong his nature, the absence of Marius had changed something inside him. He wouldn't for all the world have taken a step toward the little bastard, but he suffered. He never inquired about him, but he thought about him constantly. He lived more and more like a recluse in the Marais. He was gay and violent yet, as before, but his gaiety had a convulsive hardness about it as though it contained pain and anger, and his violent outbursts always ended in a sort of sweet and gloomy exhaustion. He sometimes said, "Oh, if he turned up here again, I'd give him such a hiding." As for the aunt, she thought too little to love a lot. Marius was no longer anything more to her than a kind of blurred black outline, and she had wound up busying herself with him a good deal less than with the cat, or the parrot she probably kept. What increased the secret suffering of old man Gillenormand is that he kept it completely bottled up inside, and never let any of it show. His chagrin was like those newly invented furnaces that burn their own smoke. Sometimes it happened that some blundering, officious person would speak to him of Marius and ask him, "What is Monsieur your grandson doing now? What's become of him?" The old bourgeois would answer, with a sigh if he was too sad, or giving his cuff a flick if he wanted to appear casual, "Monsieur le Baron Pontmercy is pettifogging in some hole." While the old man was having his regrets, Marius was rejoicing. As with all good hearts, adversity had taken away his bitterness. He thought of Monsieur Gillenormand only with kindness, but he was determined never to receive anything more from the man who had been rotten to his father. This was now the toned-down translation of his initial expressions of outrage. Furthermore, he was happy to have suffered and to suffer still. It was for his father. His hard life satisfied and pleased him. He told himself, with a sort of joy, that it was the very least he could do, that it was atonement, that without that he would have been punished in a different way and later on for his unholy indifference to his father, and to such a father, that it would not have been right for his father to have had all the suffering and for him to have none, and that, in any case, his travails and his deprivation were nothing next to the heroic life of the colonel, that in the end the only way he could get closer to his father and to be like him was to be valiant in the face of poverty just as his father had been brave in the face of the enemy, and that that was no doubt what the colonel had meant by the words, "He will be worthy of it," words that Marius continued to carry around with him, not on his breast, the colonel's note having disappeared, but in his heart. Then again, when his grandfather had kicked him out, he was still a child. Now he was a man. He felt it. Misery, we will say again, had been good for him. Poverty in youth, when it succeeds, has this magnificent effect. It turns the whole will toward effort and the whole soul toward aspiration. Poverty immediately pares down material life and makes it hideous. Hence those inexpressible yearnings for the ideal life. The rich young man has 100 brilliant and vulgar distractions. The horse races, hunting dogs, smoking, gambling, wining and dining, and the rest. Occupations for the nether regions of the soul at the expense of the higher and more delicate regions. The poor young man has to toil for his daily bread. He eats, and when he has eaten, all he can do is dream. He gets in for nothing to the shows God puts on for him. He looks at the sky, space, the stars, the flowers, children, humanity among whom he suffers, creation in which he shines. He looks so hard at humanity, he sees its soul. He looks so hard at creation, he sees God. He dreams and he feels grand. He dreams on and he feels full of love. He goes from the self-obsession of the suffering man to the compassion of the meditative man. A wonderful feeling grows inside him, self-forgetfulness and pity for all. In thinking of the numberless pleasures nature offers, gives and lavishes on those with open hearts, and refuses to closed hearts, he ends up feeling sorry for the millionaires of money. For he is a millionaire of the mind. All hatred goes out of his heart as all light enters his mind. Anyway, is he unhappy? No. The misery of a young man is never miserable. Any young man, whatever, no matter how poor he may be, with his health, his strength, his lively step, his shining eyes, his blood racing through his veins, his black hair, his fresh cheeks, his rosy lips, his white teeth, his pure breath, will always be the envy of an aged emperor. Then again, every morning he sets out to earn his bread again, and while his hands are gaining his bread, his backbone is gaining firmness. His brain is gaining ideas. When his job is done, he returns to ineffable ecstasies, to contemplations, to sheer delights. He lives with his feet in affliction, in impediment, on the cobblestones, in the brambles, sometimes in the mud, but with his head in the light. He is strong, serene, gentle, peaceful, attentive, serious, content with little, benevolent. And he praises God for having given him these two riches that are lacking in many of the rich: work, which makes him free, and thought, which makes him worthy. This is what had happened to Marius. He had even erred on the side of contemplation, if the truth be known. The day he managed to earn his living more or less securely, he had stopped there, finding it good to be poor and cutting back on work to give more time to thought, which meant he sometimes spent whole days daydreaming, lost and absorbed like a visionary in the mute ravishment of ecstasy and inner radiance. This is how he posed the problem of his life: to work as little as possible at material work, in order to work as much as possible at intangible work. In other words, to give a few hours to real life and to pour the rest into infinity. He could not see, thinking that he lacked for nothing, that contemplation, thus interpreted, ends up becoming a form of laziness, that he had been content to master the primary necessities of life and was resting on his laurels too soon. It was obvious that, for such an energetic and generous nature, this could only be a transitory phase, and that at the first collision with the inevitable complications of fate, Marius would snap out of it. Meanwhile, although he was a lawyer, and whatever old man Gillenormand might think, he was not busy pleading. He was not even busy pettifogging. Reverie had turned him away from the practice of law. Hanging around with attorneys, following the courts, looking for causes. Boring. What was the point? He could see no reason for boosting his livelihood that way. The obscure commercial bookshop had ended up providing him with secure work, work that didn't involve much labor, and this, as we have just explained, was enough for him. One of the booksellers for whom he worked, Monsieur Magimel, I think, had offered to put him up at his place to give him a decent room, furnish him with regular work, and pay him 1,500 francs a year. To have a decent room! 1,500 francs! All very well. But to give up his freedom, to be a wage-earner, a kind of lettered clerk. To Marius's mind, if he accepted this offer, his position would be both better and worse at once. He'd regain material well-being and lose his dignity. It was complete and beautiful adversity turned into ugly and absurd inconvenience, something similar to a blind man's gaining sight in one eye. He turned the offer down. Marius lived a solitary life. Through his inclination to stay on the outside of everything, and also because he had been really scared off, he quite deliberately did not throw himself into the group presided over by Enjolras. They had stayed good friends. They were ready to help each other out in every possible way, should the occasion arise, but nothing more. Marius had two true friends, one young, Courfeyrac, and one old, Monsieur Mabeuf. He leaned toward the old one. For a start, he was indebted to him for the revolution that had occurred inside him. He was indebted to him for having known and loved his father. "He removed my cataracts," he said to himself. Certainly, the churchwarden had been decisive. But in that particular instance, Monsieur Mabeuf had not been anything more than the imperturbable and calm agent of fate. He had enlightened Marius by chance and unwittingly, like a candle that someone happens to be carrying. He had been the candle, and not the someone. As for Marius's inner political revolution, Monsieur Mabeuf was wholly incapable of understanding it, of wanting it, or of directing it. Since we will come across Monsieur Mabeuf later, a few words are not out of place here. Monsieur Mabeuf. The day Monsieur Mabeuf said to Marius, "Of course I approve of political opinions," he was expressing his true frame of mind. All political opinions were indifferent to him, and he approved of all of them, without distinguishing between them, so that they would leave him in peace, much the way the Greeks called the Furies, the beautiful, the good, the charming, the Eumenides. Monsieur Mabeuf's own political stance was to love plants with a passion, and books more than anything in the world. Like everyone else, he was an ist, without which no one in those days could have survived. But he was neither a royalist, nor a Bonapartist, nor a Chartist, nor an Orleanist, nor an anarchist. He was a bouquinist, devoted to old books. He did not understand how men could waste their time hating each other over such poppycock as the Charter, democracy, legitimism, the monarchy, the republic, and so on, when there were in this world all sorts of mosses, grasses, and shrubs that they could look at, and heaps of folios, and even 32mo editions that they could leaf through. He took good care not to be useless. Having books did not stop him from reading. Being a botanist did not stop him from being a gardener. In the days when he knew Pontmercy, there had been this sympathy between the colonel and himself, which was that what the colonel did for flowers, he did for fruit. Monsieur Mabeuf had managed to produce seedling pears as tasty as the pears of Saint-Germain. One of these hybrids gave birth, it would seem, to the early autumn Mirabelle plum, so celebrated today, and no less fragrant than the summer Mirabelle. He went to mass more out of goodness than devoutness, and also because, though he loved people's faces, he hated their noise, and it was only in church that he found them gathered together in silence. Feeling that he ought to be something in government, he had chosen the career of church warden. Apart from this, he had never loved any woman,
as much as a tulip bulb, or any man as much as an Elsevier typeface. He was way past 60 when someone asked him one day, "Haven't you ever been married?"
"I forget."
When he occasionally let loose, and who doesn't, with an, "Oh, if only I were rich," it was not ogling some young filly, like old man Gillenormand, but gazing at a book. He lived alone with an old housekeeper. He was a bit gouty, and when he slept, his old fingers, stiff with rheumatism, clutched at the sheets. He had produced and published a Flora of the Environs of Cotteret, with coloured plates, a fairly highly regarded work of which he owned the copper plates and which he sold himself. People came two or three times a day to ring the bell of his home in the Rue Mézières to buy it. He made a good 2,000 francs a year from it. That was more or less the sum total of his fortune. Although he was poor, he had had the talent to amass, through patience, self-denial, and time, a precious collection of rare editions in all genres. He never went out without a book under his arm, and he often came home with two. The only decoration in the four rooms on the ground floor that, along with the garden, comprised his dwelling, were framed herbariums and old master engravings. The sight of a sabre or a gun froze him. He had never gone near a cannon in his life, not even at the Invalides. He had a reasonably strong stomach, a brother who was a curé, completely white hair, no more teeth left either in his mouth or in his mind, a tremor that shook his whole body, a Picardy accent, a boyish laugh, a propensity to frighten easily, and the look of an old woolly sheep. With all that, no other friend or intimate acquaintance among the living than an old bookseller of the Port Saint-Jacques called Royol. His dream was to adapt and grow indigo in France. His housekeeper, too, was a permutation on innocence. The poor old soul was a virgin. Sultan, her tomcat, who could have meowed Allegri's Miserere in the Sistine Chapel, had filled her heart and been enough for the quota of passion she had in her. None of her dreams had gone as far as a man. She had never been able to get beyond her cat. Like him, she had whiskers. Her glory lay in her bonnets, which were always white. She whiled away her time on Sundays, after Mass, counting the linen in her trunk and spreading out on her bed all the dress materials she bought piecemeal and had never run up. She could read. Monsieur Mabeuf had nicknamed her Mother Plutarch. Monsieur Mabeuf had taken to Marius because Marius, being young and gentle, warmed up his old age without stirring up his timidity. Gentleness in the young is like the sun without the wind to old people. When Marius was saturated with military glory, with cannon powder, marches and countermarches, and all the fabulous battles in which his father had given and received such great saber slashes, he went to see Monsieur Mabeuf, and Monsieur Mabeuf would tell him about his hero from the flower's point of view. Around 1830, his brother the curé died, and almost immediately, as at nightfall, the whole horizon darkened for Monsieur Mabeuf. A bankruptcy of a notary public stripped him of 10,000 francs, which was all the money he possessed of his brother's or his own. The July Revolution ushered in a crisis in the book trade. In times of tightening belts, the first thing that does not sell is a flora. The flora of the environs of Cotteret stopped selling altogether. Weeks went by without a single buyer. Sometimes Monsieur Mabeuf would jump up at the sound of a bell. "Monsieur," Mother Plutarch would say to him sadly, "it's only the water carrier." In short, one day Monsieur Mabeuf left the Rue Mézières, abdicated his duties as churchwarden, gave up Saint-Sulpice, sold not his books but part of his prints, what he prized least, and set himself up in a little house in the Boulevard Montparnasse, where he only stayed 3 months, in any case, for two reasons. First, the ground floor and the garden cost 300 francs, and he did not dare put more than 200 francs aside for his rent. Second, being next to the Fatou shooting range, he had to listen to pistol shots all day long, which he found unbearable. He carted off his flora, his copper plates, his herbariums, his portfolios, and his books, and set up near La Salpêtrière in a kind of cottage in the village of Austerlitz, where he had 3 rooms and a hedged-in garden with a well for 50 écus a year.
He took advantage of the move to sell nearly all his furniture. The day he stepped into the new place, he was very light-hearted and himself.